All options are on the table. The president has made that clear. The continued provocations by the rogue regime in North Korea are unacceptable.
Regional alliances tighten after North Korea's second ICBM test. It's Tuesday, August 1st. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also online right now at VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, China's president looks for greater military power. Australia's military facing a grim allegation. Kenya recognizes a tribe of Asian descent, diagnosing concussions, robots based on origami. The stories unfold now on VOA Asia. U.S. President Donald Trump uttered assurances during the start of his cabinet meeting Monday that the threat from North Korea will be taken care of. Quote, "We'll handle North Korea," Trump said in response to a question from a reporter. Vice President Mike Pence reiterated the United States is looking at all available options to deal with the escalating situation while he travels in Eastern Europe.
All options are on the table. The president has made that clear. The continued provocations by the rogue regime in North Korea are unacceptable. And the United States of America is going to continue to marshal the support of nations across the region and across the world to further isolate North Korea economically and diplomatically. But the era of strategic patience is over.
On Saturday, the president, a day after North Korea tested a ballistic missile it claims can reach all of the United States, took to social media with blunt chastisement of China, which is North Korea's powerful neighbor and its single significant ally. Trump wrote in a pair of Twitter posts that he was, quote, very disappointed in China, saying that they do nothing for us with North Korea, just talk. And he added, we will no longer allow this to continue. China could easily solve this problem, unquote. That was a reversal of the praise the U.S. president had previously uttered for his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping after Trump hosted him at Mar-a-Lago in early April. At that time, Trump expressed confidence that Xi would apply adequate pressure on Pyongyang to de-escalate tension on the Korean Peninsula. At the United Nations Monday, China's U.N. ambassador Liu Jieyi deflected any U.S. criticism.
If the two principal parties refuse to move towards what is required by the Security Council resolution, de-escalation of tension, negotiations to achieve denuclearization and peace and stability, and also to resume dialogue, then no matter how capable China is, China's efforts will not yield practical results.
After Friday's ICBM test launch, the second by North Korea, the United States responded with a sudden joint ballistic missile firing exercise with South Korean forces and flying a pair of U.S. Air Force B-1B bombers over the peninsula in a show of force. The U.S. Air Force Global Strike Command says an unarmed Minuteman III ICBM will be launched Wednesday from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California to, quote, validate and verify the effectiveness, readiness, and accuracy of the weapons system. North Korea's latest ICBM test is solidifying U.S. alliances in East Asia, while exacerbating already difficult relations with adversaries in the region. South Korean President Moon Jae-in, in a move that is expected to further anger neighbor China, is now calling for the full deployment of the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, missile defense system to proceed. The move reverses a decision last week to delay any further work on the project until an extended environmental study is completed. Currently, the system is partially functional with two of six mobile launchers operational. Bong Yung-shik is a political analyst at the Yonsei University Institute for North Korean Studies.
It might signal a more permanent and fundamental shift toward the direction that will strengthen the trilateral security cooperation among U.S., South Korea, and Japan.
However, security analyst Grant Newsham with the Forum for Strategic Studies in Tokyo says it's too early to tell if the liberal Moon administration's more hawkish turn is permanent.
I mean, I think we'll come back to where we've been before. It seems to be a predictable pattern where the North provokes, South Korea gets angry, and then time passes and with the forces for sort of a softer approach reassert themselves.
Since taking office in May, Moon Jae-in has sought to revive the past sunshine policy, in which the economically advanced South tried to improve relations with the impoverished North through investment and aid. But as Bong Yong-shik points out, the Moon government's recent offers of dialogue and humanitarian assistance have gone unanswered by the North.
What Moon Jae-in government has to really accept as a cold and hard reality is that things have changed since the days of the sunshine policy of the Kim Dae-jung government and the Nomuyan administration.
President Moon, who is on vacation, and U.S. President Donald Trump are expected to soon talk by phone to discuss North Korea's second purported successful test of an ICBM that independent weapons experts say demonstrates the capability to reach many parts of the United States. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe spoke with Trump on Monday. A White House statement said that Trump and Abe agreed that North Korea poses a grave and growing direct threat to the United States, Japan, South Korea, and other countries, and that the two also committed to increasing diplomatic and economic pressure. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley on Sunday expressed frustration with China's refusal to impose serious economic pain that would force North Korea to seek relief through compliance. Our thanks to VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman, VOA Seoul correspondent Brian Padden, and Yeomi Kim in Seoul for contributing to this report. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. North Korea ICBM test strengthens U.S. alliances. Dramatic protest by South Indian farmers in New Delhi highlights rural distress. Luggage screening intensified after Australia airplane plot. Four Vietnam activists arrested. First American woman conquers the dangerous K2 mountain. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories, and there's a whole lot more when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia and also the VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. For the first time since taking power in 2012, Chinese President Xi Jinping, who also heads the Central Military Commission, presided in the field over a large-scale military parade Sunday at a training base in Inner Mongolia. Marking the 90th anniversary of the People's Liberation Army, Mr. Xi said China is closer to the goal of a great rejuvenation than at any other time in history. Dressed in military fatigues, Mr. Xi exhorted thousands of military personnel to listen to and follow the Communist Party's orders and march to wherever the party points. Robert Manning, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Brent Scowcroft Center for International Security, tells VOA's Victor Beatty this is a part of President Xi's effort to consolidate his power ahead of China's 19th Communist Party Congress later this year to become the most powerful leader since Deng Xiaoping.
He's also in the midst of major military reform, so his relationship with the military is very critical to him as he goes into the Party Congress. So I suspect this high-profile political posture is related to that. And everything seems to be subordinated to his strengthening his position at the Party Congress.
How would you rate the Chinese military today?
They've succeeded in modernizing much faster than I think a lot of American analysts thought. You have to say that, particularly in the maritime area, they've built a navy very rapidly with growing capabilities. But you know, the other side of it is they're untested. They haven't really fought a major war since Korea. Even the senior leaders that directed the last war they were in was really Vietnam, and that was almost 30 years ago. So most of their senior military leadership has never really fought a war. So there's some question marks about how you rate them.
Does China's military reflect a global power today?
Yes, of course. I think that they've increased their capabilities across the board, air, naval, space. What Xi is trying to do is reorganize them, make them a little bit leaner and more efficient, reorganizing the structure of them in terms of provinces and so on. They're certainly probably, after the United States, the second most powerful military in the world.
President Xi, 2 years ago, ordered 300,000 troops cut. Has that actually taken place?
I'm not sure if it's completed, but I mean, that's part of the process of reorganization and making them kind of leaner and meaner. That's the idea. Don't forget the military They've been trying to wean them off of their business enterprises for more than a decade. Essentially, they're trying to better professionalize the military. I think they've moved forward quite a bit on that.
Was this parade primarily for domestic politics, or was there a message being sent to places like Taiwan?
They're always trying to send messages to Taiwan, but I think this was mainly to try to reinforce Xi's position domestically. As I say, everything is gearing up to head towards this party Congress.
Is China's military projecting itself around the world where it hasn't in recent years?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they have their first foreign base now in Djibouti, which is proximate to a U.S. base there, which is making a lot of Americans there uncomfortable. They have ramped up over the last 10 or 15 years their peacekeeping around the world, some of which is in places where the Chinese have substantial economic interests, like Sudan. Their military presence, their naval posture has increased. They're showing up all the way to East Africa, really. So you have Xi talking about the maritime Silk Road as part of his sort of grand vision for the Chinese dream, as he calls it.
Robert Manning said while China is not starting wars, it is becoming more assertive against Taiwan and in border areas with India, as well as in both the South and East China Seas. More than a week ago, Chinese military aircraft flew over the East China Sea near Taiwan and two Japanese islands. Happening now in Asia, severe flooding in Thailand has forced about 2,000 people into temporary shelters in the aftermath of torrential rains last week. The Meteorological Department says there's no threat from two storms hammering southern China and Taiwan, as several northeastern provinces remain flooded. Stay up to date with VOA and VOA 60. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're very glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. An inquiry is looking into allegations at an Australian Special Forces soldier who shot dead a man in Afghanistan and then planted a firearm on the body to make it look like the trooper had acted in self-defense. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports the probe is part of a far-reaching investigation of Australia's elite fighting units.
It's alleged that a member of Australia's Special Air Service, the SAS, killed an Afghan businessman during a raid on a warehouse in Afghanistan's Uruzgan province in April 2011. According to the military's official version of events, the man, who was said to be a senior figure in the Taliban, had tried to escape and had drawn a pistol before being shot dead by an SAS soldier. However, a friend of the victim, who said he witnessed the shooting, said the businessman was unarmed and hadn't tried to run away. The provincial government also said at the time there was no evidence the man was linked to Taliban insurgents. The shooting is one of a list of killings involving Australia's SAS unit that are being examined by a high-powered inquiry. It's already heard from a soldier who's claimed he helped cover up a war crime in Afghanistan. Sergeant Kevin Frost described to Australian television his account of an unlawful execution of a prisoner of war.
The particular incident that I was involved in resulted in the POW that I'd captured actually being executed, murdered. Now, I can't remember if he cut the cuffs off first or if he cut the cuffs off after he shot him. That's one point I can't remember there because I wasn't looking. I didn't want to look. I turned around and the guy was dead. He'd been shot through the forehead.
The investigation is being carried out by the Inspector General Australian Defence Force with the help of a respected Supreme Court judge in the state of New South Wales. The inquiry can compel witnesses to give evidence and has the power to refer cases to other law enforcement and government agencies. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia, Vietnam police have arrested four activists. Critics say the arrest Sunday demonstrates Vietnam's ruling Communist Party's growing intolerance for any criticism. The activists were arrested on charges of engaging in activities aimed at overthrowing the government. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, Kenya has officially recognized Kenyan nationals of Asian descent as the country's 44th tribe. The move, while largely symbolic, reflects the historic and economic contributions of the Indian community in the East African country. Supporters in the community hope the tribal designation signals the start of greater political engagement. Relambur reports for VOA from Nairobi.
Kenyans of South Asian descent, commonly referred to as Muindis in Kenya, are now the country's 44th tribe. Fred Matiang'i, Kenya's acting Minister of Interior, made the announcement July 21st on behalf of Kenya's president.
Now you are part and parcel of us formally. You are part and parcel of Kenya's great family. And we expect that we will continue this integration in all spheres of life, socially, culturally, economically, and actually, even in terms of participation in government and government processes.
Indians started coming into East Africa in the 17th century. The advent of colonial rule then expanded businesses and employment opportunities, including serving in the British Army in East Africa and building the Kenya-Uganda Railway. Shakil Shabir's father was among the thousands of Indian laborers who built the railway of a century ago. Shabir's family remained in Kenya, and the MP is now one of the four elected officials of Asian descent in Kenya. Shabir told VOA that while Indians have enjoyed economic success in Kenya for generations, many have remained on the sidelines politically. He hopes the tribal designation will change that.
You feel more comfortable now than you did before? Okay, maybe it was a cultural thing. Maybe you needed to be recognized. We've recognized you. Now what? It's a two-way job. You've been recognized by the system. Now we want you to now take your role in society.
The tribal designation recognizes Kenya of Asian descent who already have Kenya nationality, meaning their parents were born in Kenya. Farah Manzoor is a fifth-generation Kenyan of Indian descent. She's also an activist who spearheaded the quest for recognition beginning in 2010.
How it will help us, you know, like in the parliament even, okay, the Muindis have been there. But now we are a minority, okay, we are a tribe. We will be given allocations. Okay, in Paris statutes, not all of us, I'm not saying it should be given to all of us, but you will see Muindis now in government institutions.
While the tribal designation may raise the community's profile, it does not confer specific rights and privileges. Not everyone sees the point. Zahid Rajan is a writer and a member of the Kenya Asian Forum steering committee.
In terms of our rights and our participation, Kenyans as a whole have been marginalized. You know, the outcry in the body politic is that we want inclusivity in governance, you know, and in the running of our own life. That inclusivity right now does not exist because you've got dominance of one or two ethnic groups. I think to push for the rights of a minority community to seek special status is both wrong and divisive.
Critics see political calculation in the timing of the government's announcement, with hotly contested nationwide elections just weeks away. The community of Kenyans of Asian descent number in the tens of thousands. The latest census data from 2009 puts the total at just over 46,000. Kenya's decision has revived activism in the Indian community in neighboring Uganda. Activists there are reiterating the call they made to President Yoweri Museveni in 2014 to amend the constitution to make them Uganda's 66th tribe. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Developing at this hour in Asia, Vanessa O'Brien has become the first American woman to summit K2, the world's second highest mountain at 8,611 meters. She had a 12-member international team of climbers with her and planted the U.S. flag on top of K2 July 28th. The mountain at Pakistan's border with China is considered one of the world's most dangerous for climbers. Visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, origami, the ancient Japanese art of paper folding, can create cranes whose wings flap and frogs that jump. Well, before folding her script, VOA's Deborah Block tells us engineers are taking the same idea and applying it to robots.
This triangular origami robot is just 6 millimeters thick and weighs only 26 grams. Like triangular Lego blocks, engineers can snap together modules to create robots with all kinds of geometric shapes. Their flexibility means they can lay flat to slide into small places and then pop up into a multi-sided pyramid shape to accomplish all kinds of tasks. Researchers at EPFL, the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, are working on the new prototype.
You want them to communicate with each other so that they can create different workforce tasks under a remote environment where normal robots or larger robots or more expensive robots have difficulty to get into.
The modules can be folded into an endless variety of shapes.
They are made of multiple layers of flat sheet material, and we fold them together. We fold it to obtain the 3D shape of the robot. And then we introduce other components, like electronic components for sensing and communication, as well as battery for powering on board.
The robots are inexpensive, easy to manufacture, and can be mass-produced.
You should not cry over a lost robot or a broken one on the way. So we want this to be a cheap, easy solution for transferring information. And in order to do that, you need these robots to also have multiple modes of locomotion. So current status of these robots can crawl, hop, and even jump to go over different types of obstacles.
Researchers say the versatile system will broaden its use in fields such as human-robot interaction. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
Authorities in France, followed this week by those in Britain, are trying to curb increasingly serious air pollution in their cities. And they announced that they will ban the sale of new gas and diesel-powered cars by 2040. This could speed up the still tepid sale of hybrid electric vehicles. But in the meantime, engineers are working hard to make sure that such cars are more attractive. VOA's George Pudich reports researchers at the University of California say their mileage could be improved with smarter onboard computers.
Electric propulsion is slowly but surely taking over from the fossil fuel engines.
All cars released to the market after 2019 will be electrified. Then we talk about three levels. First step is to recover the brake energy in a hybrid system. Second is the twin engine system we already have on the market, and then the all electric propulsion, third level.
The interim hybrid electric cars already have energy management systems that switch from electric to gas propulsion depending on the speed and required power. But researchers at the University of California, Riverside, say there's still room for improvement.
What we're doing and proposing is not only look at the sensor data on the vehicle, but look at data also outside. So traffic data, traffic signal data, and also looking at patterns and how people drive.
Researchers say more powerful algorithms will soon be able to analyze a driver's habits to determine when to switch between gasoline and electric propulsion.
For this type of plug-in electric algorithms, it's pretty near term. I mean, I would think it's probably 3 to 5 years out, simply because the data exists, the communication capability exists. It's really just putting more smarts on the vehicle that can take advantage of that information.
Researchers say better algorithms could improve fuel efficiency of hybrid electric cars by more than 30%. George Pudich, VOA News, Washington.
Already powered by electricity is Star Radio FM 88.3, the voice of Chung Rung at Chung Rung Christian University in Tainan, Taiwan, who also carries our program. We thank everybody there who's been listening today and everyone around the world, however and wherever you're listening to our program. You can always get us on iTunes and SoundCloud. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook, or even get our program, if you missed it in any other venue, from our website at voanews.com. We'd also like to hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook's a great place to send us a message, as is our email, voaasia@voanews.com. Our directors, Tracy Carter, engineer Daryl Smith, managing editor Diane Gao. Let's not forget Ali Ogden and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.